Good evening, and welcome to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. It's graduation time again across the country, with colleges and universities holding their commencement exercises, including Boston University, earlier today. In honor of all the hard work leading up to this important milestone in a young person's life, we thought we'd share with you some of that work. Specifically, stories written and produced by students from this semester's Narrative Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication here at Boston University. The students were given the following assignment: produce a story exploring the theme of people's relationship to their work and how that work defines them. As you might expect, the stories varied widely. We begin with this report from Caitlin Breese.
It was very scary. Because the first time I didn't hear people in the street selling their goods, like people waking you up in the morning or hearing the rooster.
This is John Apollone. The 38-year-old Boston resident immigrated from Haiti at age 17.
I was like, wow, I wanted to be here so badly because my mother was already here. But I was like, wow, there was nobody to talk to. My mother was like, oh, this country is very different than Haiti.
Many Haitian immigrants have trouble finding jobs due to lack of education or the ability to speak English. It's often hard to support themselves.
So it's just like, it was a very big change. But also, do I find a home here in Boston? Because I felt like, you know, there were a lot of Haitian families and there were a lot of great people, foreigners who really saw the good in me.
The majority of Haitian immigrants end up working in administrative, technical, or sales support, earning minimum wage. Apollone, though, fell in love with dance at an early age. According to statistics from the Boston Redevelopment Authority, Apollone is part of just 1% of Haitian immigrants in the city working in the arts.
I'm a dance instructor, Haitian traditional, modern ballet, and some other genres. And I felt like, you know, even though I miss that village feel in Haiti, but here somehow, you know, going to school and starting to go to the dance community, and I start building that. So I feel better.
But his family wasn't always supportive.
My family relationship with dance is very, very mediocre. Because in Haiti, a lot of the time boys were very stigmatized to dance. Because they think, like, if you dance, you automatically, you're going to be very effeminate or you're going to be automatically gay.
But for Apollone, there was no other choice about how to make a living.
If it wasn't for dance, I would not be talking to you right now, because I'd be maybe injecting drugs or maybe in the street running, because my father was brutally murdered in Haiti in 1991, pretty much almost in front of us.
His father had been an undercover narcotics investigator who was killed. His dismembered remains were brought back to his family. Apollone says dance kept him together during this trauma.
When I teach, it's just really healed me. And I feel like a lot of people say the same thing to me, that they find that healing and they find that comfortable moment.
One of the classes Apollone teaches is at a community center in Via Victoria, a housing complex in Boston's South End. The class is in the building's auditorium. At first glance, the space is intimidating, with high, intricately painted ceilings and a large stage at the front. 15 or so students come here every week. Some are experienced, others are just trying it out.
Your value is pretty much the beginning of all.
Apollone comes alive when he starts to teach. His energy is infectious and entertaining as he leads students through difficult movements. Think drill sergeant meets pop icon.
Miss Chacha is going to be here. One, Miss Christian.
The warm-up alone has everyone sweating within minutes. Apollone says this is meant to be an experience beyond exercise. It's a way to discover Haitian culture.
Now we're going to start with your value. Let's work it out.
I feel like, you know, in Haiti there is not really understanding what really America means. And I feel like in America also there is not really a good understanding about what Haiti means. So I'm trying to build that bridge.
It's going to be hot.
His spine appears fluid as he demonstrates the first round of Haitian dance styles, Yon Velou, which, as Apollone explains to the class, imitates the movement of the snake and the water.
Water, you are the water, you are the snake, you are everything that really moves with the understanding, you are that energy. So work it out. Do not be shy. Please don't.
Apollon can draw a crowd. His Saturday class at the dance complex in Central Square draws more than 80 people each week.
That Saturday class at the dance complex is one of the special ones because every time I feel like there is a special day and I cannot really differentiate what was different between, because every day people are like, oh my God, it's so different. Oh my God, that was so special today.
However, his classes weren't always so popular.
When I first started to teach this class was 11 or 10 years ago, where I only had 3 people in the class. 3 people only. And I was coming all the way from New York, and every time I come in, I didn't even have money to even pay my musicians.
At one point, Apollon almost gave up teaching, but his students encouraged him to continue. He says he lives comfortably now, but not without working very hard.
60 to 70 hours a week, teaching, dancing, and working with my company. Waking up at 6:30 in the morning, going to work, and come back home on like 7:30 or 8 o'clock at night.
But Apollon says it's worth it.
A ballerina's career is often seen on a timeline, one that begins before the dancer enters puberty, and if they're lucky, ends in their late 30s. It's a profession fueled by intense competition and dedication, and is performed purely for the love of ballet. It's 1 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, and the Boston Ballet Ensemble is beginning its rehearsal of Close to Check. It's a ballet program featuring 3 performances by 3 different choreographers. Brittany Stone, from East Hartford, Connecticut, is among the dancers rehearsing. She spends her weekdays in the studio from 9:45 in the morning to 6:30 at night. She begins in her warm-up ballet class, then to various rehearsals for upcoming performances, all in pursuit of perfection.
You can rehearse something to no end, but getting on stage is really, whenever I get on stage, I'm like, okay, this is why I'm doing it kind of thing, you know?
Stone moved to New York when she was just 13. To attend the Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis School in American Ballet Theater.
It was really difficult, especially for my family, because we had to split up our family. When I was 13, I was asked to join the Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis School in American Ballet Theater, and my mom and younger brother moved with me to New York while my older brother and dad stayed in Connecticut.
Although Stone spends her days in the studio working to perfect her skill, she's also taking first steps to prepare for a career aside from dance. She's taking online courses at Northeastern University. It's an opportunity Boston Ballet offers to its dancers.
It's good to have that kind of outlet and to start getting those under our belt, getting those credits. That's kind of hard, too, in a way, because you have to learn how to manage your time. I haven't had to do that in a while, so it's hard because I'm a procrastinator.
Because she puts all her energy into dancing, she finds little motivation to get her assignments completed.
Yeah, we're always kind of physically and mentally drained by the end of the day, so it's a challenge to do our work.
Boston Ballet encourages its dancers to pursue their education to make sure they have career options outside of the unpredictable world of dance. But Brittany Stone says the online courses seem irrelevant. She can't imagine a life outside of dance. She hopes to become a ballet instructor, known as a ballet master, when she retires.
A lot of people going to teaching or become ballet masters. Like, we have a ballet master here, Larissa Ponomarenko, who was a dancer in the company 2 years ago, and she retired and now she's teaching us.
Larissa Ponomarenko danced with the Boston Ballet for 18 years. She says the transition from performer to teacher was easier than she expected.
I don't feel like I transited anywhere. I keep doing the same thing, you know, making art is just from a little bit different perspective. And, it's a bit harder mentally and psychologically, but less physically. So it works out.
As for Brittany Stone, the next step in her career is to advance to a soloist.
My dream role is Giselle.
Giselle Giselle is a romantic French ballet about love and loss.
Just because it's, I grew up watching Giselle, watching the classical ballet, and I love the steps, I love the music, and the story. It's just kind of like the quintessential classical ballet, and I would love to do it.
Ponomarenko thinks Stone will be beautiful as Giselle.
You know, long limbs, willowy arms, and she would be fantastic in the second act and would be wonderful in that first act with those huge, wide-open eyes.
Stone is so focused on becoming the best dancer she can, she dismisses the possibility of injury. She is confident she could work through it.
I haven't had any serious injuries, just the occasional, like, back spasm. We have physical therapy, so that's great.
What does that include?
Just whatever you need, you sign up for a spot, and then she'll work on anything that's hurting you.
At 1:55 p.m., ballet rehearsal is winding down, and Stone's weekend is just hours away. But first, she has to run through her performance once more before having 2 days of unscheduled free time.
It's a lot different than what I would have pictured my life would be if I didn't dance, if I just went to school and then college. It's backwards. I'm working now, and then I'll get a degree later on. So it's different than expected, but hopefully it'll work out in the end.
Brittany Stone's ambition to dance professionally is one that only the best dancers achieve. She does not see injury, sickness, or even pursuing her education inhibiting her. And like the master, Larissa Ponomarenko, Stone wants to teach when she can no longer dance. But that's an opportunity only awarded to the most accomplished ballerinas. One day she would like to have a family, but for now, it's all about dance.
Student reporter Stacy Shepherd. Before that, we heard a report from Caitlin Breese. This is Boston University's World of Ideas, and tonight we're featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Narrative Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. I'm Deborah Becker. In our next segment, reports by Megan Churchy, Rachel Ehrenberg, and this one by Peter Jasinski.
A report from the Community Health Network of North Central Massachusetts, spanning the years 2006 until 2011, showed that Gardner had a suicide rate that was twice as high as the state average. But not that many people in Gardner know that.
So were you aware of the fact that Gardner has one of the highest suicide rates in the state?
No. Not until somebody mentioned it earlier.
Does that surprise you?
It does. I'm really surprised that Gardner would be one of those places.
Around here, we're generally just like friendly towns, so I don't know. Seems like we're all just one big community. So I think you would hear about it more often.
It's kind of shocking.
Yeah, I would say so.
The people here that die of suicide, usually it's gunshot wound or hanging. My sister lives down in Newport, Rhode Island. There's a lot of, you know, it's the bridge there.
Lynn Gavingadal is the founder of the Greater Gardner Area Suicide Support Group. It's an organization that she created 3 years ago in response to the rising number of people taking their own lives. The group's aim is to comfort the friends and family of suicide victims.
We have people from all ranges of life, young people, old people, people that have lost a spouse, a sibling, their child, a friend. We pretty much will all have a tear in our eye for the person that comes in for that first time because we know how they feel.
The group meets twice a month. During these meetings, people will simply talk. Sometimes about their loved ones, but not always. No one's ever pressured to share. All that is expected of anyone is to just listen. It's a simple service that was born out of Kavingadal's own personal experiences.
I lost my son 10 years ago to suicide. He was my youngest, and the support that I got after he passed, I had to give it back. A friend of mine, a co-worker, maybe 5 years ago, lost her daughter, and she had no family to really speak of. And that's when I said, you know what? People need a place to go, a place to go and talk and just, you know, to know that they're not alone and that we're all here to listen, because that's what everybody did to me, is listen.
The support group is one of the new community programs that works with the Greater Gardner Suicide Prevention Task Force. The task force is made up of representatives from the local hospitals, schools, and the police and fire departments. They pool their resources and skills to combat their community's high suicide rate. Men, particularly between the ages of 25 and 64, are the most at risk.
Men, as a group, tend to have a much higher completion rate. In fact, men are 4 times more likely to die by suicide than women.
Mike Ellis is the former president of the Gardner Chamber of Commerce. Now he works as a member of the Suicide Prevention Task Force.
Women, though, will attempt suicide 3 times more often than men will. But men use more lethal means. They tend to have more kind of finite plans, and they avoid disclosing those plans.
Ellis's job is to raise awareness of suicide in different men's groups in the community. He educates people on some of the lesser-known realities of mental health issues and reassures community members that open discussion is not only helpful, but necessary.
You play through injuries. We're kind of taught that early on in life. You have a football injury, you play through it. You could get back on the field, and we're not really encouraged to seek medical help, or certainly ever encouraged to seek psychological counseling.
Most hospitals are getting out of the mental health business because it doesn't pay.
Barbara Nealon is the director of social services at Gardner's Henry Haywood Hospital and a leader of the task force.
We have large unemployment, the cost of health care. There's still people, even though we're supposed to have health care for everybody. It's not true. The transportation, the lack of transportation. The economy, where's the big business? The furniture capital of New England is a lovely place to live. Great for to buy a house. But once you buy it, how do you keep it? And if you're unemployed and you don't have a house and you don't know where your next meal's coming from, what's there to live for? Now I've really depressed you.
The economy is not the only factor blamed for the high suicide rate. A recent state health department survey shows Gardner has the second highest percentage of children living below the poverty line in northern Worcester County. It has the second highest number of families with incomes of less than $20,000 a year, and the second highest number of residents without high school diplomas. Another major factor is one that members of the task force say does not show up in the data.
There's still that stereotype and the stigma associated with somebody who's depressed. If somebody's hurting in the head, we should be treating them. We should be helping them. Suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. I want everybody in the community to take this as a personal message, to go forward and look at their coworkers, at their family and friends, to take this message home and to save a life. We are human beings, and we really need to help each other as human beings.
Suicide remains a problem in Gardner. In the last 2 years, there were 44 confirmed suicides. As of the beginning of this month, this year's total is 3.
It's chilly in the Davis Square subway station in Somerville. Water's dripping down a far wall. On the platform, people are scrolling through their phones, and MBTA workers are keeping the trains running.
The next Red Line train to Alewife is now arriving.
It's not always it's the easiest job. You know, people don't know what's into the job. They just think, oh, well, how easy is that? But there's a lot involved. When you have a rush hour, you have 2,000 people on the train, makes it difficult.
That's the voice of someone you seldom see.
I'm Ed Pagioni, and I'm a Red Line motor person for the MBTA.
And what does that mean you do every day?
Motor person is the person that drives the train back and forth.
Pagioni's worked for the MBTA for more than 15 years.
Motor person is the person that drives the train back and forth into the station, make the announcements, open the doors, shut the door safely, make sure everything is good before we move on.
Sounds straightforward, right? Not so fast. Train motor people are exposed to a surprising amount of human drama. Women have given birth on trains. There are brawls. People fall on the tracks.
I used to work the night shift when you get all the crazy stuff happening. The drunks and the fights. All that craziness goes on at night.
When stuff gets really hairy, the drivers have to step in.
I was actually in the middle of a guy and a girl fighting, They were, I don't know, with liquor. They had a bottle of liquor, and one lady said a guy was hitting her. I went out, and then they started swinging over me, and the liquor was spilling all over me. I remember that.
These days, Padone works the morning shift.
I grew up in Revere on a dead-end street, and there was tracks on the other side. We used to hang around as kids. But that's the closest I ever got to tracks before I started here.
The job has its technical challenges, including stopping the train. You've got to line it up just right with the platform.
When you're first learning, it's hard to stop in that, right in that area. So a lot of times you'll go right through, or you'll be too short. And you'll have to, if you go through, you have to back the train up. And there's ways we can do that. But yeah, it's a whole crazy thing until you actually learn it all.
There's also danger. Padone points out a major hazard at the Braintree station.
That's the third rail, that's 600 volts. So that is what's running all the trains, the power. That power goes, you'll see the shoes on the bottom of the trains that slide across there.
The third rail is that raised extra line of track that provides electric power to the trains. Another source of danger, the passengers themselves. Padone remembers having to make a quick stop to avoid hitting someone.
And he was on drugs, I guess, and he fell right in front of the train. I was able to stop the train. I laid on the horn, and he ran on his knees to try to get out and try to jump out. So you feel good about stuff like that.
That attitude serves Padone well. Even without the distractions of occasional emergencies, the job requires concentration.
When you're driving a train, you always have, you know, you have time to always think, so you always have to be careful of that, you know, don't get into too much thoughts. But, anything, you know, if you have something going on in your personal life or something home, you just have to watch out driving a train, because if you're not paying attention, you can easily go right through the station. So you always have to be aware of that stuff. But
have you ever done that, gone through a station?
No. You always come close to stuff like that when you have things going on. Like when my mother was sick and she had passed away in 2006, I had a lot on my mind. So, you know, that goes through your mind. And next thing you know, you're at a station. And you have to be able to stop that train.
At the end of the day, it's usually the same things that frustrate passengers that frustrate Ed Padone.
My thinking always is I feel bad for the people that are stuck on the trains, because I've sat in stations half hour, 45 minutes for whatever reason the problem was, and those make it really difficult. You feel bad. You feel bad that, you know, people get on the train, they want to go somewhere, and they're stuck on the trains.
But none of it seems to ruffle Padone.
But I go in. I'm a happy guy. I go in, and people say hi to me. I say hi. And, you know, if you have a person that's miserable or just doesn't want to talk, whatever. My head's always out the window. I'm doing my job, and I get my regular people that say hi to me every day, good morning, the whole thing. You get all different kinds, whatever. I go with the flow.
Let me ask you, how do I get to the commuter line here?
Just go straight out, and when you go through the gate, you'll see the sign.
Thank you.
Yep.
Padone's not even bothered by spending his days in the dark, subterranean maze that lies beneath Boston.
The tunnels. Now when I come out and I see the beautiful Boston light.
And Padone's looking forward to exploring the tunnels and coming into the light for many years to come.
I'm going to try to flip this thing over now, which is a rather daring thing to do.
When I watched the movie Julia and Juliet, I cried the whole time.
That's Ron Saviner, owner of Saviner's Market. He loves the 2009 homage to Julia Child.
It was supposed to be a comedy. My wife kept elbowing me, "Stop it, what are you crying for?" It was because that movie really made me realize, you know, what I do is a lot because of what she did for my family and the business and the love affair she had with Saviner's and me and my dad.
Julia Child lived in Cambridge, right across the street from Saviner's Market. Though there is now a Beacon Hill location, Ron Saviner spends most of his time in Cambridge. In 1939, his grandparents opened what was then called United Service Supermarket. Saviner's father later took over.
My dad was like a local legend. People loved him. He was what you just define as a wonderful human being.
Jack Saviner had been a medical student at Tufts when his father died. Saviner dropped out and turned his scalpel to non-human anatomy and into life as a butcher.
And then in 1964, this tall, gawky lady walked in the store and She was a woman by the name of Julia Child. And her and my dad just had this love affair for food. And she loved me. And she loved my dad. And they just had a wonderful friendship above and beyond everything.
Savener appeared on Julia Child's television show to demonstrate butchering. Because Ron Savener says Julia Child actually always wanted to be a butcher. In fact, he says that Savener's was the first business mentioned on public television that was not a sponsor, just because of Child.
We're roasting Miss Chicken today on The French Chef!
Ron Savener came into the business as an owner in 1986. Child was still a regular customer and now a world-famous cookbook author.
I ended up butchering meat for her for The Way to Cook. And I remember her saying to me, I used to think of your dad as my butcher, but now I think of you as my butcher. It was like I achieved some goal in life. That was an honor to hear that from her, really, you know?
But since Child's time, there's been a sharp decline in butchers and the number of butcher shops. The industry has changed, and more people are buying cheaper meat in grocery stores.
It's actually really hard to find butchers these days.
That's Adam Lucia, the buyer and brand manager at Savener's. He stands on the left-hand side of the shop near the game meat. Up front are fresh fruits and vegetables. Red meats and exotic meats are to the right.
It used to be an apprentice type of position, and so oftentimes we end up employing people that worked in the restaurant industry or who might have gone to culinary school and have an interest in meat and then trying to train them. It is an art that has been replaced by boxed beef and pre-cut meat.
The butchers work in the back of the shop, where their butchery is kept as old school as possible.
People aren't required to know how to break an animal down. It's all boxed beef. Here's a sirloin strip, cut it into steaks and trim it. Now, ask that gentleman where it comes from, and he'll probably tell you a cow. We can tell you the breed and where it came from. People want to know where their beef and lamb and all that stuff come from.
Savener wants to teach his staff to be real butchers.
But what we've seen now in the industry is, you know, there's really a cry for the old-fashioned butcher shop, which is, you know, what we are, in local pasture-raised beef. We have a really bigger demand for it now.
Adam Lucia thinks that this business works best in Cambridge and Beacon Hill because of all the people in those areas who want to know where their food is coming from.
I think that we don't see a lot of decrease in sales based on an interest in vegetarianism. I think that if we're communicating correctly to our customer, then we should be explaining to them the health benefits of well-sourced and well-slaughtered animals.
For some people, like Elaine Corey, who has been a Savener's customer for 20 years, a butcher can be a deciding factor on where to purchase meat.
They're real butchers here. They know what they're doing.
And you can ask them for a specific cut or whatever, and you can get it.
I like to know what I'm eating. And they're also pretty good about choosing good meat, and you're likely to get a really good cut here.
Good, fresh food from local sources. That's the mantra that Ron Savener thinks Julia Child would also be proud of.
The woman saw me grow up, and she was so psyched to see me passionate about doing this because she saw that the trade industry was really dying in terms of skilled master butchers.
Ron Savener continues to teach his employees what Julia Child once showed him. Butchery is his passion, his art, one that he does not want to see lost.
That story filed by student reporter Megan Turchi. Up next, reports from Jessica Pratty, Jamie Bologna, and leading us off, Michaela LaFranc.
Ruby Nails is tucked onto the ground floor of an office building on Mass Ave in Boston, in the shadow of Symphony Hall. The walls are painted pastel green, punctuated with framed stock photos of white flowers and French manicured hands. It's an oasis amidst a gray office landscape. On a weekday afternoon, two teenage girls are pondering an assortment of polishes mounted on the far wall, while an older woman eases herself into a plush, tan pedicure chair and plunges her feet into a tub of steamy water. A TV that nobody's watching is on in the background. Five women are at work, carefully shaping and painting nails. The manager has the table closest to the door.
You're my last name too, or it doesn't matter? Okay, my name is Anna. My last name is Huynh. Spell is H-U-Y-N-H. And I'm from Vietnam.
Anna Huynh is 36. She has short black hair and bubblegum pink lipstick. She immigrated here with her parents when she was only 11 years old.
I have to work at a factory and stuff like that. You know, like heavy-duty work, cold. Wake up at 2 in the morning, you know, things like that. Harder. Pick orange, pick apple. So they've been through a lot.
It was tough, physical work, but they wanted a part of what so many immigrants still believe in, the American dream.
Being in the U.S. is a lot of opportunity for anyone, not just like Vietnamese people, you know. The job-wise, you know, in Vietnam, my cousin...
Juan says her cousin only makes $100 a month.
Compared to us here, like, that's a day or 2 days, you know? So that's very good. If I were in Vietnam, I'd probably make roughly the same as her, you know?
Juan might downplay it, but she knows what it means to work hard. She got her nail care license when she was only 17, a senior in high school.
When I got started, I got to start really hard. They don't want to hire me.
She's come a long way since then. Her husband, who's training to be a doctor, actually owns this salon. But Juan says it really should be in her name. She manages everything, and she has all the skills.
I know how to do everything. I do. I can do mani, pedi, manicure, pedicure, acrylic, full set. Pretty much I know everything because I'm the manager here. You pretty much have to know.
Her favorite part of the job? Chatting.
And it's really nice because you get to talk to people. So I get to chat. I'm a chatter. So, because when you get to sit in front of a customer, then you know them better. And sometimes you know a whole story. A lot of customers can tell you the whole story about them.
It's pretty clear that Juan loves her work and her clients. But there are a few things that get under her skin.
And the customer attitude, that's the hardest part. For working, it's nothing hard. And we don't have lunch until like 5 or 6 o'clock. That's, we don't even eat lunch just because to get people in and out. We sacrifice that with some rich kids come in here just want to... Anyway, I think customer service is the hardest part. You cannot satisfy everybody, but those unhappy is always going to be unhappy no matter where they go.
Juan is also a pretty mellow person. Warts and foot fungus don't really bother her. But there is one thing that does. Fake nails.
If you don't have any nails, how am I going to put on a tip for you? And if I put in a tip for you, it probably don't stay on, you know, just because you don't have the nail bed to support it. Don't tell me that because I don't have nails, that's why I want it on. Yes, I understand that, but I just have to tell you, it may not last. Thank you. See you next time.
Applying all those fake nails and polishes means touching a lot of chemicals. There are lots of studies about those chemicals' long-term effects on the health of salon workers, but the results are pretty inconclusive.
For me right now, I feel sometimes I get numb at night, but I'm sure about the road, we probably have a hand problem. Yeah, and health too, I'm sure. So it's nothing, you know, it's your job. So.
And it's a pretty good job, she says. The women act like a big family, trading shifts when one person's child care falls through, or one of their kids gets sick. Here's one of Juan's employees, Amy Lee.
So we work together, look like a family, and I feel I see them more than I see my family. So we try to get along well.
They're a family. When Juan talks about her family, it's hard sometimes to know if she's talking about actual relatives or her coworkers.
I'm glad that I'm here. I don't think I can survive back then. It's not like we're not a wealthy family, you know. We came here to get the opportunity to be better. And I feel like, yeah, we got it. Yeah.
As the day draws to an end, Juan wants to get home to her family. But she decides to squeeze in one last customer. It means another couple dollars in tip, a little more time at the salon, one last set of nails. She wants to get home, but in its own way, the salon is home too.
His name is Billy.
It's Kotsioulos. Kotsioulos. I got to break it up in syllables even when I spell it out.
That was the first time I had heard his last name. In my family, he was known just as Billy the Greek.
You know, everybody thinks that I'm Italian every time they see me, so they always thought, oh, you're Italian. They're like, nope, I'm Greek, Billy the Greek. So it just rolls off the tongue and it stuck from the very beginning, and everybody's always called me that.
Okay, full disclosure. Billy the Greek is my cousin Johnny's best friend. Just saying that makes me feel like all of this is some scene out of My Cousin Vinny or something. But the thing is, in an Italian family, everyone's a cousin. Johnny's great-grandparents were my great-grandparents. But enough about me. Here's my cousin, Johnny Lodato, talking about Billy the Greek.
He's my brother. He's the closest
The closest thing I have to a brother.
They work together for Johnny's plumbing company. Billy drives a white truck that looks like an ambulance, only one filled with home improvement tools, a plumber's torch, and plastic pipes. Billy and his apprentice Gaetano start their morning by battling a tombstone-sized rock.
Yeah, how heavy would you say that rock was?
I'd say probably about 350 pounds.
That's the fight you were talking about?
Yeah, definitely was the fight that I was talking about. I told you, we're not even here 5 minutes, and that's the first thing we started doing, was fighting a huge piece of granite out of a hole.
And we got another one, right?
Yep, there's another one right next to it. Looks about the same size. So, round two is coming up.
Billy uses the words fighting and arguing a lot to describe his relationship with Johnny.
It's a lot easier to, like, flip off your friend opposed to somebody, you know, like a boss, you know, a typical boss that you wouldn't think twice to say anything. But, yeah, we get into heated arguments all the time.
Like, with other contractors.
Yeah, plumbers will just really swipe.
And most often, to describe his relationship to his work.
Clogged drain that you can be fighting for a long time, you can finally get it, and it's just, yeah, oh yeah, no, it fights, it hits you back, yeah, yeah, you get slapped in the face with it once in a while, and then you slap it back, oh, it's a... That's another thing, the impeding danger of getting hurt.
Every day?
Yeah.
Yeah.
These drills, they got a lot of torque, a lot of power, it'll twist your whole arm off.
Wow.
That thing, I got almost cut my finger off with it before. Always, always.
Always in the back of your head.
Yeah, there's always something.
And at 31, Billy says he's starting to feel the job take a toll on him physically.
My back's already twisted up. My knees are 3 times the normal size. It's just, it takes a huge toll on your body. You definitely do sacrifice a lot. Breathing in a lot of stuff that you shouldn't be in breathing in, you know. So that kind of sits in you a little bit and just kind of weighs on you, especially now that I have kids and now I see myself wanting to be sticking around a little longer than I ever cared to.
After high school, Billy decided college wasn't for him, and in 2001, he left his family's restaurant to work as a plumber's apprentice. He met my cousin Johnny, and they've worked together ever since. Both Johnny and Billy say that the years, and even Johnny's business, have taken another toll on their friendship. It's not that they're no longer friends. They see each other every day, after all. But instead of coworkers, like they were in the good old days, Johnny is technically Billy's boss. My cousin Johnny says when he broke away from the other plumbing companies he used to work for and started his own company, Billy was supposed to be his partner.
I did a lot of thinking about it. And, you know, I always had, Billy worked his ass off, always. You know, from the day we started, he would work till 11, 12 o'clock at night, no problem, no questions asked. Never asked for extra money, but when the extra money was there, I'd break it off, you know. You know, I didn't want to lose him as a friend, making him a partner. Because then it would be a partner, and that's it. You know, it's hard to keep a friend and a partner.
Billy the Greek says the decision not to become partners also had something to do with their personalities.
We're both pretty stubborn guys. We both know what we want, and we both think we're always right with anything. Like an old married couple.
Perhaps they're an old married couple with families on the side.
We would work till 7 o'clock, go out and get drunk afterwards. We had a blast.
Yeah.
Then, you know, we meet wives, kids come into the picture.
Saying you got old?
Yeah. Well, it changes everything around.
It changes
everything. It really does. You know, then they bitch at you. Oh, you got to be home with the kids more.
And as a father, Billy the Greek says his outlook has changed.
But now, come in, punch out. I want to go home now. I don't want to lift those heavy boilers or those heavy cast iron pipes or heavy cast iron tubs anymore. Like I'm kind of careful the way I'm lifting things anymore. I'm not just kind of like sacrificing my body like I used to.
He's already starting to slow down.
I just want to be able to retire at a younger age because I won't be able to do this when I'm too old.
And that really sticks with me. He's only 4 years older than I am. I'm 27, and I'm still trying to find myself, find my career, actually start working for a living. But Billy the Greek is already thinking about retirement.
I'm taking what they're giving because I'm working for a living.
Julius James, owner of the Other Guys Moving Company, looks more like a football player than a businessman. He's responsible for not only running this Boston-based moving company, but coming up with some pretty clever ways to maneuver furniture in and out of some of Boston's most historic apartments.
Some of the very old, you know, architecture in Boston, places are over 100 years old. You know, the furniture was much smaller back then, I assume. What we have to do is try the stairs, and usually it doesn't work. And then we start pulling windows out, and, you know, you throw a couple piano straps onto the end of a couch, and it's just manpower. You toss it out the window, you have someone at the bottom kind of guiding it so it doesn't slam into the windows and the walls, and we hope for the best.
The guys have just emptied a fourth-floor brownstone in Back Bay of its belongings, save for a large leather couch. The couch is so large, in fact, that it can't fit down the winding staircase. They've decided there's only one way out, the window.
Oh, God. Say a prayer.
Man, you're the man. Freddy, pull it, Freddy, pull it away. Walk away, walk away. Keep walking. Here comes the strap.
Watch out.
James has been in the moving business for more than 8 years, starting right after graduating college where he studied business. Despite his hands-on experience, he still gets stressed out about just how meticulous this job requires him to be.
Heavy dressers. I guess the craziest thing would be whenever we do a really heavy piano, like a grand piano, just the stress of, like, they're so expensive and they're so heavy and, you know, they're extremely beautiful pieces and you have to be so careful, but also you have to use, like, everything you got because they weigh, you know, 900 pounds, 1,000 pounds, 1,500 pounds. And we're always worried about, you know, damaging them or even a little nick. They're crazy because they're really heavy and dangerous, and every time you move one, you're hoping that, you know, you're not going to get killed by the thing.
Light fixtures are sometimes the casualties of moving these high-cost, heavy items. So far, James and his company have been careful to avoid any accidents resulting in damaged property and legal issues.
If we did, I guess we would immediately call our insurance rep and get some paperwork started.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty much why we have our insurance is our carrier and our liability moving, which companies are supposed to have. And if we didn't, I probably wouldn't even bother taking the job.
While James does get his hands dirty, he says his strong suit is good customer service to help calm the nerves of anxious tenants during their move.
And of course, as a scared mom, I'm like freaking out. We have to be out within 7 days.
The heavy lifting also fosters camaraderie with his coworkers.
All the guys are really personable. We're not robots. We come in and we BS with you and we try to lightly joke just to keep things cool with everybody. And the guys work really hard and it's a tough job. I mean, guys could show up and whine and moan about the stairs and how heavy everything is, but it's good to be doing something physical and, you know, talking with your coworkers and meeting some new people every single job. And I keep getting very lucky with the guys who are working with me. The guys have good heads on them. They're just nice guys.
James never intended to make moving a career, but has found it to be surprisingly rewarding.
It's my business now because I got into moving, and we're not really sure how. I just needed a job at some point. I was out of college, and I was looking for a job, and I'm a big guy, athletic. I was like, moving. You know, I could bounce around the city, do physical labor every day, make some cash, whatever. And it just fit. It's good work. It's physical. It's cool.
Looking ahead, James plans on hiring more employees so that he can avoid some of the heavy lifting and spend more of his time in the less physically demanding realm of an office space.
Student reporter Jessica Pratty. This is WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. You're listening to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's narrative radio journalism class in the College of Communication. Tonight's theme is people's relationship to their work and how that work defines them. In our final story tonight, we hear from student reporter Alastair Burrell.
Betsy Siggins sits in her Watertown home, reminiscing about Bob Dylan.
I was there when he went electric, and we were sort of pals then.
Siggins was at Dylan's controversial electric performance at the Newport Folk Festival in 1965.
He'd stayed at my house a couple of times. That was a very profound and interesting shift for the music that was to come. And we were in tears just thinking that, you know, how can you boo somebody who's so eclectically wonderful?
Siggins is one of the founders of Club 47, a legendary folk venue in Cambridge that helped launch the 60s folk revival. She was roommates with Joan Baez at BU, and she was present for many of the defining moments of the 60s, including the March on Washington and the annual festivals in Newport.
And I do remember going backstage, because we had backstage passes back then. I mean, anybody could kind of go anywhere. And Dylan sat down in my lap on just a fold-out chair, and he just sat and he never said a word after that performance. That was pretty memorable.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me.
Siggins' living room is full of records, CDs, and books. A few cats roam about. There are posters on the walls from obscure folk bands from the 60s and 70s. Folk music became her whole world while in college. She eventually dropped out to help run the folk club.
And we were really, really lucky because none of us came into that spot having any idea that that would be both our college, our graduate school, and perhaps our life. And for me, I wasn't a musician, and I didn't have the temerity to want to book people. I took people under my wing, but just as musician friends. But it turned out to be my life. Now, what was your question?
She wasn't just a fan of the scene. Siggins was really involved with it. The folk revival has its roots in the 40s and 50s, when musicians and folklorists took a renewed interest in the Southern stories and ballads of the late 1800s. The revival really blossomed in the 60s, no small part thanks to the big names like Dylan. For Siggins, what made the 60s revival so important was the music's social impact.
But we got exposed to an enormous amount of American history, culture, social issues, the war issues, and civil rights. And that was like a great big pot that everything sort of like stirred around in.
Siggins worked at Club 47 until it closed in 1968. When she left, she took with her a collection of memorabilia. After moving around the country, she worked at the eventual successor to 47, Club Passim. She collected even more memorabilia.
Well, what happened was when the club closed, nobody knew what to do with anything. You know, we had some ephemera, but we didn't have a lot. But what we had, I took, and I had a bag of reel-to-reel tapes in a plastic bag. I think of that now, and I shudder.
But it was less than optimal storage for 50-year-old archival tape.
So again, I moved all those boxes and all those reel-to-reels, not having ever listened to them since I left Club 47. Photographers who were interested in folk musicians began saying, would you like a copy of this? Would you like a copy of that? And pretty soon, I had a huge closet full of stuff, unorganized. And when I left the club, it was with the understanding that all of that would go with me. It was mine. I don't know that you can call them archives yet.
Virgil Cain is my name, and I drove on the banjo treadmill. So much cavalry came and tore up the tracks again.
The collection has about 900 pieces. There is a hand-typed poem by Bob Dylan, every release from Rounder Records, pictures, old magazines, personal letters, and recordings of the live shows, including one of the first recordings of Doc Watson. Some of it lives in the basement of the Somerville Armory, and other pieces live in the Cambridge Historical Society. And the rest is scattered throughout various locations in the Northeast.
But we need to take that next step and get everything categorized, and we need to know what's in every box.
A $5,000 grant from the Grammy Foundation was enough to get some of the tapes digitized at Harvard University. But work has stalled since then.
What we did with the rest of the money was to take all those reel-to-reels to Harvard University's audio preservation department, and they worked a miracle. Took about a year. We still don't have them up on our website because we don't have our website completed because we ran out of money. But they're in the Harvard archives, and people, I guess students and academics can listen to them at Harvard. But we just got stalled. When you run out of money, you run out of money.
Siggins's goal is to get everything organized enough to take it on a countrywide tour.
But of course, nobody has a salary, so people have to come and go as other work appears for them. So I think now that it's our fifth year, we really have to make this the year of raising awareness so that we can raise some real money so we can complete the stuff.
After a tour, Siggins eventually wants to find a permanent home for the archive, but she just can't afford that right now. But the 73-year-old Siggins says she wants to see the archive in one piece while she's still able to curate it.
Lord, I'm sitting on top of the world.
Student reporter Alistair Burrell. That concludes tonight's special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's narrative radio journalism class in the College of Communication. Our student contributors were, in order of appearance, Caitlin Breezy, Stacy Shepherd, Peter Jasinski, Rachel Ehrenberg, Megan Turchi, Michaela LaFranc, Jamie Bologna, Jessica Pratty, and Alistair Burrell. Thanks to Boston University Associate Professor Ann Donahue, who helped edit their stories. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mark Degon and Michael Garth, with help from Marquise Neal. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Congratulations to all of today's graduates, and thanks for joining us.